Our childhood defines us in some ways. There are things we learn from our childhood that we keep with us, and there are things that we have to unlearn and let go of. Talk to me about your childhood. What are some things you have kept with you, and what are some things you've had to let go of?
Gosh, that's a great question. And maybe a little bit of background about my childhood or where I grew up. So I was born and raised in San Francisco, like truly in San Francisco proper. I'm the son of a immigrant family. My parents actually immigrated from Burma, also now known as Myanmar, from a Chinese culture. And so I lived with my parents. I lived with my two brothers and sisters and my grandparents. So in some respects, we had a sort of a traditional Chinese family that was always sort of proper, I'll say. You have to wait your turn. You have to, exercise your manners to the highest degree. Always respect your elders, be in place. And I would say that those aren't bad things, of course. You want to be respectful. You want to honor the wisdom of people who have more experience than you. At the same time, I think that some of that feels a bit restrictive. Right, because you always have to, do things in sequence, wait your turn, and be confined to so some of those rules. Thinking about where I am today, if I had not branched out or reached out or done things outside of the box, I would not have had. The great experience that I've been able to experience throughout my career, in enjoying the ability to express my creativity, my innovation, and making the impact that I feel like I would have otherwise not been able to make if I sort of stayed confined within sort of, I feel like a box that a traditional Chinese family, might put myself in. That's some of what I think about in response to your question there, and I'm happy to expand if that's something we want to take down the road here.
If you go back to, say, your 20, 25-year self when you were starting med school, what did you think your career trajectory would look like, and how has it differed in reality?
Oh gosh, yeah. Back then, when you're early 20s, you think you know everything already. Because gosh, 2 decades on this planet, gosh, you know everything. You know where your career is going to go. You know what your family is going to look like, and there are so many twists and turns that have come up along the way. The vision that I had when I was 20 is actually quite different than what's actually happened in reality, and quite honestly, I wouldn't change a thing. Back then, I was thinking, I'm gonna go to med school. I'm going to specialize in internal medicine, which I did. I'm gonna be a primary care physician, which I have been, and that's what I was gonna do for my entire career. I was really interested in having that sort of longitudinal care that primary care physicians get to have with their patients, to be expert in a lot of different conditions, the broad breadth of what internal medicine has to offer. And I've really enjoyed doing that part of medicine. And I've done that for many years, actually. But along the way, I was blessed with the opportunity to expand outside of that. One thing that happened early in my career after I finished residency was that my medical group deployed Epic, the electronic health record, 1 year into my practice, which was, I would say life-changing in many ways, and life-changing for a lot of people, because of course you're no longer talking on paper, you're putting everything in the electronic health record now. But it was not long after that happened where the inefficiencies of dealing with electronic health record became very apparent. Don't get me wrong, I would never go back to paper. There's so many advantages of having things in an electronic format that we would never go back. I would never go back. And the quality of care that we deliver now is so much better because of that. But as we all know, working within an EHR, all the clicks, all the keystrokes, all the different screens, and all the administrative tasks that we're dealing with now, they became into play when the EHR was introduced. And so I saw opportunities early on after the deployment of the EHR around being able to improve the efficiency of which I was operating within the EHR, and to help my colleagues who were equally struggling with getting through their day. Not only were they now faced with having to provide excellent care to their patients, they had to figure out, well, how do I get this ordered in the system? How do I place this referral? How do I do any of these electronic tasks now that are in there in a quick way, so that I'm not spending, twice as much time in front of the computer as I am, in front of a patient. So, along the path, I got to program tools into the system that improved our efficiency, that made us get through our day more quickly. I developed a program that went viral across my medical group very quickly, actually, and it's still actually used today within the Kaiser Permanente where I was practicing in the past. And that was sort of my foray into creating technologies or leveraging existing technologies to integrate into the practice that allows us to get through our day more quickly with as little friction as possible. So, it's been very fulfilling, but at the same time, gosh, there's just so much more that can be done that I can see, and that's some of the work that I'm still doing now, even though I'm no longer with the current medical group that I'm at. I'm still doing work in technology integration within healthcare.
This transition from clinical medicine to physician, innovator, entrepreneur, and leader, was it you following your natural curiosity at that point, or was it something more planned and something you had to train yourself to excel in?
I would say it was not planned. There are some people out there, I think, that have a grand master plan, the moment they were born, or the moment they went to high school or college or med school or wherever, and they have a grand vision of this is where I need to be, or this is where I want to be. Things for me kind of happened organically and naturally over a period of many years. I have to give thanks to the many mentors that I had along the way who saw potential in me, who pushed me, who gave me opportunities to do things that they felt I could do that I didn't even know I could do myself, and helped me develop and helped me grow into having those abilities to be able to do more than just clinical care. Now, I kind of hate to say that, because just clinical care, oh my gosh, it's such a noble, important thing to do. And at the same time, there are other things that can be done to help at a larger level, at a larger scale, which I've been fortunate enough to have those opportunities to do along the way. I would say it wasn't necessarily kind of, I wasn't born with that. It wasn't innate in me. But I learned that through the practice of what I was doing, educational courses that I attended, and of course the mentors that I had along the way who helped educate me, teach me, and build on what I had, I think, as the foundational aspects of what I could accomplish to where I have come today.
For the physicians listening, a lot of them would like to cut back on clinical medicine and expand their scope in non-clinical side gigs. What's stopping them is that the immediate loss in income that you often see. What advice do you have to those physicians? And what made you take this leap into non-clinical medicine? And be okay with the short-term loss in income.
Yeah. Well, my leap into non-clinical medicine, like I mentioned, could happen over a long period of time. I started as a 10-tenths primary care physician, did that for a number of years, and over time, say, went from 9-tenths to 8-tenths to 5-tenths, and so on. And I'll say that it was always important to me to continue to practice medicine because it was always that was my goal coming out of medical school, to be a doctor. And even now, I still see patients because it's such a fulfilling part of what I do, during my week, during my month, during the years. And it's such an important part of what I do in my non-clinical world because being able to see patients and understand the challenges and the joys of clinical care allows me to have a better understanding of how to shape the technology that I'm working on, that is helping hundreds, tens of thousands, and hopefully hundreds of thousands, even millions of other clinicians out there eventually to be able to sustain their practice to continue to build on their clinical careers. You didn't ask this question, but I'm gonna opine a little bit here around, why are people looking for side gigs and trying to get out of clinical medicine? And I think it's because clinical medicine is so hard. And it's hard for a number of reasons. It's hard because the demands of knowing all this information and trying to apply it to the best care delivery that they can to the patients they're taking care of, it takes a toll. And that's why I actually am so enthusiastic about technology and artificial intelligence, because those are things that can help offload the cognitive burden of clinical medicine aspects. But on top of that, of having to deal with the clinical aspects, there's these whole administrative aspects that clinicians have to deal with, which, when I was in med school, I didn't think about that. I didn't think about, prior authorizations and clinical documentation and all the notes that we have to, things like that. I didn't think about that, but they're very readily apparent in today's clinical world that there are so many administrative burdens placed on clinicians that I think that's one of the reasons why they're very willing to try to give up some of their clinical time, even though it is as rewarding as it is, to find things outside of clinical medicine. Advice that I would give, well, be true to why you're wanting to venture outside of clinical care, because if it's to make money, as you just mentioned, there are probably better ways to do that, or at least short term, because being a doctor, being a clinician, has its financial rewards as well. But if you're not true to yourself and you aren't following your passions, what you stand for, what you believe in, it's going to make it that much more challenging. And for me, after as I sort of decreased the amount of time I spent at the clinic, I felt like there was a higher calling, a higher level of responsibility that I could have to have an even bigger impact aside from the individual patient that I was seeing, within the office. And so putting that all together has continued to drive me to do the work that I do, to have a larger impact across healthcare, across society.
Another thing that physicians struggle with, I think, is balancing finances, retirement planning, and lifestyle creep, especially as we get into our late 30s, 40s. How do you think about these things when you make career decisions? And what is your general outlook on financial planning as a physician?
Yeah, I think it's hard to generalize because everyone's different in terms of their income earning potential as well as what their lifestyle is. And if I, it's funny, I talked to my wife this time, for good or bad, our lifestyle is fairly similar to when we first met in residency and we were working on a residency salary, compared to when we both became practicing physicians and had a much higher salary to live off of. And even at that, having had two kids now, we still live a fairly modest life. I mean, we take our vacations, and we like to enjoy the time we have with each other, things like that, of course. And so for me, the financial aspects of it are obviously important. We had to pay off school loans, and we still need to take care of two kids, and plan for their futures as well. But thankfully, because our lifestyles aren't necessarily extravagant, we're able to get by with what we've been doing. Now, I think it's absolutely critical, though, to do financial planning because, again, everyone's different. And if you have certain things that you want to accomplish in life, you want to do goals that you have, and they're expensive, you have to think about what you're going to do with your work and your earning potential. And man, I think of where I went in terms of my career, or if I had just stuck with being a primary care physician, and my decision to go into primary care, if I had larger loans that I had to pay off, in deciding which residency to go into, which specialty to go into, I may have picked a completely different path. I may have tried to go into orthopedic surgery or become a cardiologist, some procedurally based specialty that pays more than a primary care physician. But thankfully, I was able to balance the finances of it and my interests and my passions to pursue a career where I thought would be professionally satisfying. And that's, again, how I ended up in primary care. So, it's a tough question because everyone's different, everyone has different goals, and the situation varies from person to person.
How do you think about balancing your personal life and your career life, specifically with kids as well? And this is something I've learned with kids is you can't be more efficient at parenting because what kids want is your time. You can spend time, you can't spend 10 minutes with them in a better manner. They need more of your time every day, ideally. So how do you think about balancing your personal and career life, and where does happiness lie for you on that spectrum?
Wow, so you're right. I mean, kids, family, those are first and foremost the top of my priority. Talking about sort of traditional Chinese family, it was always family and health. Those are the two sort of untouchables. We always talked about that. And then it was like, well, how are you going to make a living? So that was, that was secondary. And I think, as you asked earlier, what have you carried into sort of adulthood and into your career? Those are things that I think about. And the things that allow me to find balance in my career and in my family life is having variety. I think is one of the biggest things, having variety and having challenges, because let's talk about variety here. I mean, doing the same thing over and over, I think it'll be easy to get bored. And if you want to do something for the long haul, for an entire career, for your entire life, having that variety is, I think, one of the most important things to keep in mind. And I think that's one of the things and one of the reasons that I kind of took the leap of faith of leaving my practice of what I had for 20 years to do something different, to join a AI startup company, to work at a medical school, and to still maintain some clinical practice, is that within my work life, I've got a variety of things that I get to work on that I feel like I'm having a positive impact on, either at an individual level, at a larger organizational level, or the future lives of physicians that are students who are training to be physicians. So, I always believe that if you're doing something fun and exciting at work, it often doesn't feel like work. It's just that's what you're doing during your day. And I feel like a lot of that is what I get to do during my professional time. But in terms of my family time, my time away from work, I've got two kids. They're both teenagers now, and you talked about time and spending time with them. And as I think about, my daughter, who's 16, a junior in high school, my gosh, it's going to be like a year and a half before she's off to college. And the time that I get to see her every day and get to spend time with her and talk to her every day and to see her continue to grow into to adulthood, that time is shrinking. And it's sad to see, but also so exciting to have her be able to, develop into her own and explore her own future. So just trying to cherish every moment that, I have with my 13-year-old daughter, or 16-year-old daughter, 13-year-old son, with my wife, at home, traveling, experiencing different cultures, forming those core memories that hopefully they're going to remember the rest of their lives, where they took that trip with mom and dad, and they can tell their grandkids or great grandkids about, and just sort of building that legacy for the future. Those are the things that I think about.
I'm jealous of you, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like your natural inclination is family, health, and then career. My natural inclination is career, family, and then health. And that's caused quite a bit of grief, and a few episodes of burnout in my life. And I'm working really hard to change the order of that too, as you said. Family, health, and then career. I guess my question is, what piece of advice do you have for me and people like me? And you know, the people in the startup ecosystem are often like this. And as an investor, you know, I look for founders, and maybe I shouldn't, who put their startup above all. So what advice do you have for me? And is that your natural inclination, or have you had periods in your time where, and I'm sure you have, where your career asked you to compromise your family or your health, or you had opportunities, you know, which may lead to financial freedom in 3, 4 years, but they would come at a cost of family and health. And how do you think about these things?
So you're spot on and very observant about what I feel like my priorities are. And you know, I don't think these are necessarily fixed in place at all times, just as you mentioned, because there have been times where I've had to prioritize my career so that I could take care of my family. There are times that my health, unfortunately, has suffered because either I didn't get enough exercise, my diet was terrible, I just didn't have enough time for sleep because I was focusing on the career aspects and making sure that that piece was successful. And I'm not going to say that someone who prioritizes and has their career at the top and then career, family, and health in that order is wrong. I don't think it's wrong. I think it depends on.
I think it's wrong,
You think it's wrong?
but
Okay.
yeah, but
Well,
go ahead.
I think it's where you are in your life and where you sit and what your perspectives are. And I think people can have different perspectives, and I think it can be right. But the way I see it is this: if you don't have your health, and maybe I'm making a case for health being on top, but if you don't have your health, you're going to have a much harder time taking care of your family. And if you don't have your health, you're not going to be optimally performing at your job. Over the past several years, I've been very interested in lifestyle medicine, and thinking about how physical activity, diet and nutrition, stress reduction, sleep, avoiding unhealthy substances, and social interconnectedness, those pillars of lifestyle medicine play into family and work. And so I recently became board certified in lifestyle medicine because I have such a strong interest in it and want to apply that to my own health and my own family, but also impart those principles to the patients that I see and the people that I work with. And so, you know, if you don't have your health, it just makes it more difficult to do those other pieces that we talked about. And the family aspect, you know, I've had disagreements, fights with my immediate family. I think all families do. And I remember a time where I was probably in my early 20s and I had a big argument with my brother. I've got two brothers, one sister. And I didn't talk to that brother for months. And my mom, she's like, well, you know what? He's your family. You're not going to build other brothers. Well, she was done with having kids. She wasn't going to have any more brothers for me. And your family is your family. And when it comes down to it, at least within our culture and our family, there's no one that's going to have your back like your family. There's no one that's going to be there who's going to support you in your time of need. And there's no one going to be that is in tune with who you are, how you grew up, the culture that you are part of to be able to have that level of support that others may try to give you. So I feel like that's why the family aspect is such an important piece of sort of that layering that we talked about here.
Let's talk a bit more about lifestyle medicine. And you know, lifestyle medicine and longevity medicine, they both still have somewhat of a bad rap in the academic and the clinical world, although I find it is changing slowly. What are some biomarkers that you thought were, foo-foo, and when you did lifestyle medicine training, you've kind of changed your mind on? And maybe you'll surprise me and say cortisol levels. But talk to me about, because this is something I'm interested in as well, and I think a lot of physicians are starting to get interested in. There's a big push towards hormone balancing. And like if your testosterone, and I'm used to the older scale is 9, which is within the normal range. Like if you want it to be 14, 15, and you feel better, that's fine. But if you push it beyond the normal ranges, and then we can get into, well, how do the normal ranges exist? Is it based on a specific Western white male population? And does that apply? Like, is the normal range of testosterone different for a different population and different age groups? And we just don't have the data for a lot of these things, or maybe we do, and I'm stuck in my med school days or residency days. So, talk to me about lifestyle medicine. What are some things you've changed your mind on by learning more and training in lifestyle medicine?
So I mean, I know you asked about sort of biomarkers and hormone levels and things like that. And when I think about lifestyle medicine, I don't honestly, I don't think as much of in terms of those terms as what I'm about to say that I think of in the terms that I consider lifestyle medicine. And some of the bad rap I think that you hear about or you think about that's out there is like, oh, it's just about eating plants and vegetables. Like, and it's about being zen and just sort of disconnecting from all the evils of society. I'll just throw that out there. But there's real evidence around being able to use lifestyle medicine to treat diseases, to prevent diseases, and to reverse diseases. And so what we're talking about here are things like chronic diseases in general, obesity, diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, cancer, dementia, all those things, all those conditions. If we were able to fully realize the potential of lifestyle medicine, we could likely eliminate 80% of those chronic conditions. We could save millions of lives, really, by practicing those pillars of lifestyle medicine. And there is real data. Like you think about, studies in New England Journal of Medicine, Annals of Internal Medicine, JAMA, different things like that. There's real studies that have been done to show that, I'm not just, speaking fluff here. There are peer-reviewed journals that have shown the benefits of lifestyle medicine here. And so, if we could impart even some of these principles to more of what we do in the care of our patients, I think we'd be so much better off. And I'm not also not saying we don't need medicine and we don't need procedures, and that's definitely not the case. Putting those things in place and complementary with and then looking at the patient in a holistic manner, we need all of that to take care of patients, because despite our best efforts, we're going to need medicine. We're going to need procedures to help treat and protect our patients. So.
So one thing I've noticed anecdotally, I've been prescribing as with a lot of us, a decent amount of GLP-1, Ozempic, Mounjaro, Wegovy, is sarcopenia. And for those listening who are not medical, sarcopenia is this phenomena of muscle loss or loss of muscle mass as we get older, and it's been shown to link. Be linked with mortality, morbidity, dementia, and muscle mass is very important, especially as you get into your 80s and 90s and maybe even 70s. What are your thoughts on, and I'm asking this more as a personal thought, because I think the evidence is still kind of out there of GLP-1 inhibitors. Are they the lifesaver that we think they are? Or are we going to get more data, and do you think it will kind of fizzle out?
Gosh, at the trajectory that it's been going in, it's hard to imagine it fizzling out at the rate that we're going at right now, with all the benefits that we are seeing with the GLP-1s. So much chronic disease out there is related to obesity and being overweight, and that's why I'm a believer in lifestyle medicine too. I know it's perhaps not as easy as prescribing a pill or prescribing an injection to help lose weight. But as patients do lose weight, the diabetes disappears, the hypertension disappears, and we know what those conditions can lead to down the road after years and years of having that, or even not even that long of having those type of conditions. So I'm very much encouraged by what the GLP-1s have been able to do. Sometimes we just the shortages that are seemingly easing up, but the cost is still very high. I worry a little about sort of the equitable distribution of these type of medications that we can apply to our populations. With that said too, sort of the beautiful thing of medicine and academic medicine is that we are constantly learning. And the longer we use these type of medications, the more patients who are out there who've been exposed to them for a longer period of time, we'll learn more. There are, potential side effects, as you know, of course, to these medications, and we'll be find out potentially more side effects as the years pass. I like to bring up the example of fen-phen, right? We thought it was such a great treatment for weight loss, but it was shown to, cause valvular issues with the heart. And then so we obviously no longer use that combination of medication. But hopefully the GLP-1s are not going to have that fen-phen moment and continue to prove to be safe and effective and life-changing in many respects.
And talking about equity and medical treatment and care being equitable, and excellent medical care being ubiquitous and equitable worldwide, it seems like the one of the costs of medical care that's been targeted is us as physicians, and our salaries, which is entwined with our length of training. With the rise of NPs, it seems like there's a growing sentiment that maybe we're overtrained, overpaid. And with AI now and AI agents, there is also a growing trend that physicians should be replaced. So I'll ask a two-part question. What do you think is the role of physicians in the next 5 to 10 years? And the second part is, if AI can replace us with the same accuracy for treatment and diagnoses, should it?
Wow, that's going to be probably a $1 billion question here with respect to that. And the role of physicians over the next 5 years, I don't see the role of physicians. We're all I well, as a physician, maybe I'm biased, but I think that we're always going to need physicians. Someone that has additional expert training in being able to understand the disease processes and to be able to treat patients. Can a computer do that? Yes, to a degree. But can the computer develop the empathy and understanding and sort of put in and compute aspects of a patient's situation that a human could do? I don't think it can do that at this point here, right?
What if it can fake empathy? Is there a difference from the patient perspective if they can't tell if the empathy is fake or real? Because our perception of reality is reality, and objective reality is hard to discern.
It's a good question. Because you're probably aware of the studies that have been done too, around where Some patients felt like the chatbot was more empathetic than the human, the human physician. And so I think there's more to learn around there. And part of I think that diminishes some of the empathy that I think human physicians want to provide and can provide is based on some of the time constraints that we're faced with, some of the burnout issues that we all have. And if we were able to use technology to offload some of those things that we, again, we don't have to do, I think the burnout would be better, the time constraints would be improved. And I don't know, maybe I'm being a little old school here in thinking that we're still going to need physicians. I really believe we are. Even as technology advances, as AI agents are out there, looking at all this data, processing all of it, going out and doing tasks for us, and then bringing things back, I think when it's brought back, I really do believe there needs to be that human in the loop that we talk about, that needs to have that trained clinician with, years of experience who went through medical school, who have seen, a patient in the past that reminded them, this is what we need to look out for, or this we need to take into consideration as we're treating this patient in front of me here. And taking that, say, AI agent recommendation and applying it as it has come back, or tweaking it. Because you know this patient and you've treated this patient for 20 years and understand what their goals are, their beliefs are, and how they would want to be treated as a patient, which, I think is hard to plug into a computer algorithm and to be able to put that all together.
If your 16-year-old daughter came to you today and said, "Dad, I want to be a primary care physician," what would you tell her?
I would say follow your dreams. And in fact, she has told my wife and I that she wants to be a doctor. She's 16. She's got time to, think through whether that's the right choice for her. But I would love to support her in that decision, because I have had an amazing, fulfilling career being a primary care physician. I know that's not always the case, and I know there are a lot of doctors out there who would say, "Don't go into primary care and don't become a physician." But I think it's such a, you can give so much and you can get so much back, and you've got so much opportunity that you can have being a primary care physician. Like where I went with my career, being able to see patients, being able to integrate other interests around things like lifestyle medicine and technology into my practice and into the work that I do, and being able to affect patients on an individual level or at a population level, and having that impact, and as I reflect on the career that I've had, it's been so gratifying. And if she wants to do that, whether it's a small part of that or a large part of that, I would fully support her.
I'm mindful of the time. Do you have time for one more question?
Yeah, sure.
If your 30-year-old self saw where you were at from a career perspective today, what would they think? And where do you see yourself in 10 years from now?
My 30-year-old self, I mentioned earlier that someone in my 20s or 30s, they wouldn't know what was coming or what would happen here today. I think they would have been impressed. Like, gosh, you thought you were gonna be on this particular career path, but you got to do so much more. Experience so much more effect and have that impact that I would have never imagined. And so I feel like I am so fortunate, so privileged to have been able to go through what I've been able to and to affect the lives that I've been able to make the people healthier, people happier, people be able to get through their day better.
And where do you see yourself in 10 years?
And yours. Gosh, I've been really enjoying what I'm doing now. It's hard to imagine doing something different than I'm doing now. I'm basically mid to getting to the latter part of my career. And as long as I'm having fun and feel like I'm making an impact, I'm gonna keep on doing what I'm doing.
Thank you so much for joining me today. This has been a little bit of a therapy session for me as well, so thanks for doing that.
Me
And
too.
yeah, this has been amazing. Thanks, Ed.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.